Hey everyone, Chat Cemetery is back, as is Katie Schaefer. We are talking all about The Stand today. It is Stephen King's ginormous post-apocalyptic horror fantasy novel. There's a lot going on in this, basically, and I think it's one of those books where there's just so much going on. We could probably talk about this book for hours upon hours, but we're not going to subject you to that. Katie, how are you doing today? Are you ready to talk about The Stand?
I am. I'm doing good. This is one of my more liked King novels, like, which is saying something for me. So I'm so excited to go through it with you.
I really liked it as well. And one of the first things I want to touch on here, just because of this book having a little bit of a unique situation where there are multiple versions of it. So you have the original, which came out in 1978, and that is the version I read. I read it in paperback, so it wasn't, you know, like the first edition or anything like that, but it was one of the first paperback copies that came out for it. And then you have, you know, complete and uncut, and I think there might be another version of the book as well. There's definitely at least two, possibly three. And I know one has, you know, like some illustrations, I believe, too.
Yep, the complete and uncut edition had illustrations done by Bernie Wrightson.
Right. So which version of this did you end up reading?
The complete and uncut. And I believe that one also includes a foreword by King about why all of this stuff is being included.
Okay. So the one I read was roughly 820 pages. I imagine yours was a bit longer. I think I read that it's around 1,200 pages for that edition.
Yep, it beats out a Game of Thrones book for its size.
Yeah, so obviously you have some information available to you that I do not have just because of reading the different versions. But for the most part, the story is roughly the same. You mentioned to me before we hopped on this call that, you know, the complete and uncut edition is something that adds more, but it doesn't necessarily add anything too terribly crucial to the story. So I think for the most part, we both have the gist of what went down in this book.
Yeah, exactly. From what I've read, because I've only read the complete and uncut, it sounds like King added back in, because it was all stuff that originally he wanted published that the publisher was like, we can't do this. It's too much to print for us to sell at a reasonable price. And so he chopped 400 pages or about 150,000 words out of it. And the added back material is just kind of, it adds more life and realness to the world. And it's really, really brutal, very violent, as this kind of book would be, you know.
Exactly. And, you know, one of the other things we definitely have to talk about here is the massive amount of characters in this, because there is literally an entire Wikipedia page dedicated to just the list of characters, because you have characters in different parts of the United States at this time. We have a big group in Boulder, Colorado, and you have another group in Las Vegas, and you sort of have just people along the way as well. And, you know, it's one of those things where, because the book is so long, regardless of which version you read, is a long book. And he splits it up into three different sections, basically. It's one of those things where you do get to spend a decent amount of time with a lot of these characters. It's not like most of them just go unnoticed or something like that throughout. And it feels like he sort of figured out what exactly he wanted these characters to do, and he was able to accomplish that with each of the sections.
Yeah, that's kind of what I think. He talked about in Dance Macabre, he talks about how this was kind of like his Lord of the Rings.
Right.
And in the many different publishings and the adaptations, I was like, you don't know how right that is, sir. Because Tolkien was known for redoing his work multiple times. So I thought that kind of each character represents a different archetype and a different focus for the story. And it all kind of, because it goes from character to character in an almost chronological fashion.
Yeah.
You know, like sometimes it jumps back to what that character was doing while the previous character you read about's actions were happening. But it all goes from the beginning of the story to the end. There isn't much like jumping between time, like in, say, Stephen King's It. So, but it's, which for this story works, I think.
Right.
I don't know. How did you feel about it when you read it?
I like how chronological it is. And I know the dates change depending on which edition of the novel you're reading, but that's really only the years, not necessarily the days and months that it's taking place during. So you have, you know, this big thing that happens at the beginning of the book. Basically, you get this terrible, terrible weaponized strain of influenza that ends up being released. And you sort of see the U.S. Army freaking out about this. And it's like, okay, you know, here's patient zero and here's what's happening. And it just decimates the population. You know, 99.4% of the population is just gone. And we see what's left of that. And you have this group of people and you're like, okay, why were they not killed by this? And obviously there are going to be some people who are immune to a lot of different things. So to have 0.6% of the population left and just roaming around the United States, it's a very interesting tale. And usually I'm not super big on like post-apocalyptic novels and everything like that, but I feel like a lot of those just like throw zombies and stuff in. But this really feels like a story that is about people coming together and trying to survive something. And that can sort of be applied to things that aren't necessarily apocalyptic as well.
Yeah, I agree. I think this was before, obviously, the huge spate of post-apocalyptic stuff from, you know, the Hunger Games and all that stuff. And I think King explores it in a way that is pretty unique at the time and is something that a lot of people, I think, tend to mimic when they're writing post-apocalyptic fiction like this, where the majority of the world has been wiped out. And he does it in such a fascinating way, how he, you know, there's the original big apocalyptic event, and then he extrapolates on that idea with, when I was reading it, I thought about the second apocalyptic event that happens within like the next week or two.
Okay.
When all the people who have, and I hope this is in the original version, it has all the people who are left behind who didn't die, those people who are vulnerable, you know, like the guy who has a weak heart and he goes right. jogging and he dies jogging because there's nobody there to help him. And the person who electrocutes themselves, and there's, you know, because the population has just been so decreased that our normal standards of like what is safe and what isn't are completely gone, you know, and there's no emergency services.
Yeah, exactly what I was going to say.
Right. So it makes you look at the world. Those actions really cut away from a lot of the post-apocalyptic stuff in that it looks at the simple everyday dangers of the lives we lead that are only safe because of the world we live in.
Right.
You know, because some things we do are entirely unsafe, but it's okay because there's people all around you and there's emergency personnel and all the technology we have still works.
Yeah. And that first sort of section of the story there ends up going by the name Captain Trips. And that's the name they also give the flu. It goes by that and the super flu. They kind of vary depending on who's talking about it and everything like that. But it's one of those things where it's like, okay, we start the book off strong with this big, massive event that kills off most of the people. And you sort of just have to deal with the aftermath for the rest of the book. And that sort of brings us to the On the Border section, which is July 5th through September 6th. So you have these cross-country journeys that are being taken by various groups of people because, you know, they get word that, oh, you know, you should go here and go here. And that's sort of where we get the large groups of people in Boulder, Colorado, and then in Las Vegas. So you have these groups that are taking the same sort of journey, obviously not the same exact journey, otherwise they would all just be together, but they're making these treks, and you see how each group sort of deals with whatever they come across. And no one person really reacts to this the same way. And I think Stephen King does a really nice job of sort of giving these characters enough of their own personality to where it doesn't feel like, oh, you know, they're all sort of just reacting the same way to this huge thing that's happened. And it's sort of something that makes the story more effective, I think, by giving them all of these different reactions. And it doesn't even have to be like big reactions to things. It's sort of a lot more subtle things that each of the characters end up doing.
Right. It's hard to say who's like the main focus, but there's really three or four people who are the main focus of the book. I think there's Stuart, there's Franny, there's Nick, and Tom Cullen. And those are the people who we follow
right
the most. Oh, and yes, of course, Larry. How could I forget Larry? And each of them has an incredibly different journey and a different reaction to the world. They're all very different people. You know, Larry is an ex-drug addict and a musician. Franny is just out of high school. Tom is, you know, a special needs man. Nick is deaf. And Stu is just a regular everyman. And they're all forced to deal with how the changes in the world affect them personally. And I think for me, as a woman, I thought the inclusion of the risks that Franny now faces were particularly poignant. I think King has a really great way with thinking about things from women's perspectives and how the world affects women, and that he includes those moments where these gangs of awful men have just taken up and are now hunting women
right
to use as they want. And Franny has to deal with that risk, and is, once she finds out it's a risk, it's constantly on her mind. And she is always aware that, okay, is this person trustworthy beyond whether or not they're going to kill me for my resources? Or are they going to try to make me, you know, their slave? And he deals with that not in big detail. It's very, you know, I think there's one or two incidents, but it becomes very visceral. And that fear threads its way throughout the rest of the novel, that there is a gendered aspect to the world once there's only this tiny percentage of the population. And it's, ugh, that part of it was the worst for me.
Right. Speaking of women, though, you also have Mother Abigail, and she is basically in the center of the United States, roughly. She's this 108-year-old woman living in Hemingford Home, Nebraska. And we see groups of people end up being drawn to her. You know, they keep seeing her in their dreams, and they sort of just eventually figure out a way to get to her. And she's the one who directs them onto Boulder, Colorado, which is what they're dubbing the Free Zone. So that is where they're sort of going to rebuild democracy. And it's very interesting that you have sort of this godlike woman, even though everything else seems to be not so great for women, especially in Franny's case, like you mentioned. So there's definitely a contrast with a lot of these characters, too, because then you have, you know, sort of the opposite of Mother Abigail in Randall Flagg, who obviously is probably the biggest character of note in this story.
Right. I guess I misspoke. There's two halves to the book. You know, there's the good, the people of the light and the people of the darkness,
right.
You know, and Randall Flagg is the antithesis to Mother Abigail. And the person who I think is my favorite character somehow, or at least to me, the most interesting, is the trash can man. He is
right.
Weird and fascinating. and then Lloyd and just the evil aspects of this world are equally as fascinating as the good, and how they build a society around this dark person or entity. He's not even really a man. And, you know, it's, if you've read other Stephen King books, which I know you have, and the people who are listening to this podcast almost certainly have, this is one of the big appearances of the Randall Flagg character, who then threads his way through so many other of Stephen King's books. But I think this is the one that gives us the most personal view of Flagg.
Without actually bringing him into the story too much, too, a lot of it is what people are hearing about him. A lot of people in Vegas specifically are talking about him and what he can do. And, you know, for most of the book, I don't think we even really, quote unquote, see the character.
Right. And he doesn't get very many viewpoint sections. I think he only gets a couple, and they're upsetting when he gets them.
Right.
And I think he's given the most life and perspective of who and what he is when with Lloyd and Nadine.
Right.
Lloyd is his man, is essentially his right-hand man, and Nadine is his bride of Satan, if you will. And the two of them have a completely different perspective than everyone else, because they see him almost without that, you know, congenial mask that he wears in front of everyone else.
Yeah, like you said, too, it's a big difference between the good and the bad. And I kind of love that he put the bad people in Las Vegas.
Right? That's so, like, especially then, you know, because when he was writing it in the late 70s, early 80s, it was like Las Vegas was much more the den of iniquity, whereas now Vegas has cleaned itself up a bit. But yeah.
But it's still Vegas.
Right, exactly. And how he portrays it in the book, that is just so perfect for, you know, because it's so hot. It's so hot. And he keeps emphasizing how hot it is there. It's like, I know, King, we get it. It's hell. We understand.
Yeah, he might go a little overboard with that. But overall, I think it really works. And then obviously, Colorado is a much colder place. So you have that difference as well. And, you know, I have never been to Boulder, Colorado, but I know people who live in Colorado, and my parents have been there a few times now, and it definitely can get cold. Pretty cold there.
I have been to Boulder, Colorado recently. Actually, I went this year, and I went and I was like, oh, I guess I can see why he would pick this. It's a very almost quintessential small town, and it's set right at the mountains. Like, you literally out from giant peaks of mountain, and then the equivalent of two city blocks later, you're in a town. And it's situated in such a way that it feels very desolate around it because the mountains are right on the edge, but it also feels kind of developed, like a small city. And so I feel like I get why he chose that. It is this perfectly balanced place where they have all of those resources that, you know, a society wanting to start up in that environment would want, but it's also kind of a desolate place, and it's set above ground level. It feels safer because it's an enclave almost.
I'm seeing here that in the complete and uncut edition, it gives you a little more on the kid too, who in the original version of the book, he's mostly seen in flashbacks and things like that. And it says here he's modeled after the spree killer Charles Starkweather, who I am not familiar with, but knowing what I know about the kid from what was in that original version, it isn't surprising that he's modeled after someone like that. So is there anything you can add sort of to what the complete and uncut edition expands on with the kid?
Oh, yes. Okay. So this was what I was wondering, and now that I know which version you read, I'm so fascinated to know what you saw from that book, because the kid is a small side character, but he makes a huge impression.
Right.
Because at one point, the trash man, when he is traveling to get to Flag, he meets up with the kid and they have a horrific like 3 or 4 days together before Flag essentially kills the kid with wolves. And because he knows about the trash man in the book, and he is calling the trash man to come to him. So he wants him to get there, but he doesn't want this guy to come because this guy is planning, you know, he's going to take over the world. But he is this incredibly deranged, very upsetting man who is at least as scary as Flag, but not for the same reasons. Like, he's given a lot of life, if you will. Like, he feels larger than life. And I can see how King modeled him after a serial killer, especially that one, because he has no compunctions about doing whatever terrible thing comes into his head. And there's trigger warning, that is the only rape scene that happens in the book. And it's horrifying. Like, that's the scene that really cements for you that the trash man is a sympathetic character because of what's done to him by the kid. But I think that part is maybe 40 pages, It's not a whole lot considering the 400 that were added back into the book.
Right.
So do you remember what parts you see with the kid?
In the original, it's only through the Trash Can Man's flashbacks. So I don't think we really get too much of him. It's like, you know, you kind of know about the hot rod and sort of his personality and the fact that the two of them, you know, went on this journey together and the kid didn't make it all the way, sort of thing. And I don't remember if when Stu Redman is making his way to Vegas with his group, if they this is the thing. I've read the book and I remember a lot of it, but it's like small characters like this, it's hard to remember details for because it wasn't expanded on as much as it was in the edition that you read. But it's mostly just flashbacks is where we learn about the kid. And it's not too terribly many. It, you know, it's probably not even close to 40 pages in the original book.
Okay, then I can definitely see why he wouldn't, because like when I think of the kid, to me, he looms very large in that story because he's super menacing. So I can imagine that it's very slimmed down because like, oof, he's a big part of the Trash Can Man showing his devotion to Flag by making it out there because he goes through this horrific trial to make it. And yeah, he's one of King's more upsetting characters,
right,
that he's created. So I'm glad you brought him up because he's almost a force unto himself in the book.
Yeah, everything we learn about him in the original version is through the Trash Can Man. And he himself is quite the interesting character. And you mentioned, you know, he might be one of your favorites in the book. And I can definitely see that, you know, he's someone who has plenty of issues on his own too without having the kid attached to him. You know, he's a schizophrenic and a pyromaniac, so that's not a great combination.
No,
as you can imagine. And they do a nice job of explaining that in the book, and I don't know how much more of the Trash Can Man you get in the edition that you read, but we still get plenty of him in the original version.
Yeah, and I think he's, you know, considering the ending, he's kind of a pivotal, integral character as much as Stu Redmond or Franny or any of them. He's able to make a huge effect on the story. And I love that King in this book, and this is a controversial fact, a controversial choice on his part, I love that he includes all of these characters who are, you know, damaged, in as some people would say. You know, Nick is deaf. Tom Cullen is, you know, not fully cognizant of what's going on around him, and the Trash Can Man is horrifically mentally ill, and these are the characters who make these huge effects on the world around them despite their disabilities. And I love that he includes that and isn't afraid to say, well, these people are still here and these people would have an effect on the world if they survived, because that, you know, 0.6% that's left, every single one of them is probably going to make an effect on the world around them.
Exactly. I want to start talking about the third act of the book, basically. But before we do, I do want to note that you have a different ending than I do because you have an epilogue that is not in the original version. So
yes,
we're going to probably have different thoughts on how the book was ended here, simply because it's two different endings. But, you know, for me, the last line was that sort of ambiguous, I don't know. And you probably have that same line just before the epilogue, I'm guessing. But yes, I don't really know what the epilogue adds. But we will get to that because, you know, this section is Flag basically convincing his group that the Free Zone is a threat to them. And this sort of starts this war between the two sides, even though there isn't like an exact battle that happens. It's just one of those things where it's a mindset like, oh, okay, you know, these people in this area are threatening to us.
Right. And I think this is the more controversial part of the book for people, I think, because this is what leads to the end, and it takes a lot of setup to get there.
Yes.
And I like books that have this. I like books that take their time getting to their story and have a lot of characters who can interweave together. It feels epic, you know, which is what he's going for. Essentially, this is an epic fantasy story set in a post-apocalypse world. And I think for me, King pulls it off well. Like, the long journey, you know, the issue with Mother Abigail, where she goes off on, she feels she's sinned and goes off on this spiritual journey, and then catastrophe happens, and they, the newborn government has to learn to deal with that. And it's just such a fascinating setup. And then they decide they're going to go on like a quest.
Yes.
And that's the point where I was like, okay, what are we doing here? That was the point where my brain wasn't necessarily on board with how this was going to end, but I think it then did pull it off. So did you feel at any point where you like, I don't know what we're doing?
The decision to go there is one where I would be a little worried if there were plenty of people who didn't question that. I feel like most people who read The Stand probably question that decision. At least, you know, I did. And it's one of those things where you're like, okay, well, it's Mother Abigail's sort of dying wish. So, of course, they're going to go do it because she has done nothing but help them so far. And I don't know if Mother Abigail knows the extent of Randall Flagg's like supernatural powers or anything, but it's one of those things where you're like, oh, they're going to go see that guy. And even though this is sort of your first exposure to Randall Flagg within the Stephen King universe, if you have paid attention to anything, you know, regarding the Dark Tower movie or, you know, anything recently that would have sort of let you know who Randall Flagg is without really having to watch that movie or anything. It's just one of those things where if you've paid attention to Stephen King lore over the years, you probably know who Randall Flagg is before you even read anything about him, which was the case for me. And as soon as they did that, I was like, oh no.
Yeah, so he makes his first appearance in The Stand. This is the first, I had to double check on the Wikipedia for this, not gonna lie. This is his first appearance, and it makes sense because it set out a whole lot of precedent for the character and his ever-changing dark nature and his flitting between ideas and willingness to just do horrific things without even thinking about it, because it's like the kid, it's what he wants. And I was kind of like, okay, we're setting up a very traditional standoff between the good and the evil. And it felt very appropriate to have these three characters, you know, the three greatest warriors of the side of the light going and making their stand against him. And I understood it, and it turned out I was happy with it. But it does take them a while to get there. And that part does feel a little overly drawn out. I will say that.
Yeah, obviously with the 400 page difference between our two copies, some things might seem more drawn out based on which copy you are reading. But there are some things where it's just like, okay, can we kind of move this along a little faster, even with the, you know, 820-ish page version of the book, which is the one I read. And even though the book was super long, I don't know if you felt the same way with yours being, you know, 50% longer pretty much, but I didn't feel like reading this book was a drag or anything like that. Sometimes when you get really long, really dense books, it just feels like such a chore to read them. But, you know, with this, it took me a little to get into it. But once I sort of hit my stride with sitting down and just focusing and reading the book, I felt like I got through it relatively quickly.
Yeah, I did feel the same. Like once it gets going and it catches your interest, I was the same. I was like, okay, now I want to know what happens. I think it's just that at that point, you are ready for things to really get going. And then there's this longish, and it's not even that long, but at that point in the book, you are so ready for this final confrontation to defeat this evil guy that you're like, come on, get there. And that's kind of how I felt reading it. And like I said, I don't think it was actually that long. And what happens during that journey from, you know, Boulder to Las Vegas is very important because it sets up the characters as being ready for what happens in the final confrontation. But yeah, I don't know how much was added to that with the complete and uncut edition. So, and other books have done that, and I feel the same way. So I know that that's partially just me, is like, I don't like any kind of slowdown once we've started building to the final conclusion.
with the original edition, you sort of have it ending with, well, not sort of, you have it ending with Fran and Stu questioning whether or not the human race can learn from its mistakes, which, as we know in real life, sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. And they give that ambiguous answer of, I don't know, which is a pretty good answer, if you ask me. And I think
it's a true one.
Yeah, exactly. But I know your edition had more to it. So why don't you go ahead and inform me about how your version ended with the extra little epilogue that it had.
So Flag, in that final moment, it talks about, and I would almost be, I think I'll probably will do this at some point. I will buy both editions and read the last section, because in my version I read, at that very last moment when the hand of God is coming down, Flag teleports away and he ends up on a beach with a preliterate society that then starts worshiping him as a god. And he starts trying to rebuild his empire. And it's a short section. You only get a glimpse.
Right.
But when I read that, I was like, well, this is how it would be. But I really did want him to die. And I wonder if that section wasn't added because King didn't initially have that concept for Randall Flagg as being a character and a creation that weaves throughout all of his different storylines. And at that point, I think the Gunslinger would have been already published. And I don't think he had related it back to the Walter from the Gunslinger series. I have a guess that that's partially what was going on. I will have to investigate that because it makes more sense for that to be there,
right,
rather than have him just be gone, you know?
I just looked up which books that Randall Flagg has appeared in, because it's apparently been more than I suspected. So
he's in lots.
Yeah, you have him making his first appearance in this one. He also appears in The Eyes of the Dragon, which I have not made it to that book yet. So I have that to look forward to. And then obviously you have the entire Dark Tower series that sort of focuses a lot more on his character. He also appears in Hearts in Atlantis and Gwendy's Button Box, which is a way more recent book out of the rest of those, pretty much. So, you know, he's a character who made his introduction in, what, 1978 here with the original edition. And then, you know, I don't know, 40 years later, he's still prominent in some of these stories.
Right. And he has a big role in the Dark Tower, you know, a huge, huge role. And the Eyes of the Dragon has somewhat of a relation to the Dark Tower. And yeah, I think he is definitely, along with, you know, Pennywise and the evil thing that is the Shining Hotel, he is he's very good at creating villains, and I think Flag is one of the best that he's known for, because it makes sense that he weaves throughout the world. So I like the creation of Flag's character, and I think he is very well outlined in The Stand, and it sets him up for everything that comes after.
I think Stephen King honestly just has a knack for making this entire universe that somehow connects to other things within it without some of us even noticing at times. You know, you have Castle Rock, and that city obviously has so many different connections. Same with Derry. And, you know, he instead used this character to sort of do something similar that he was using cities to do before. And I don't know if I've shown it to you before, but there's this ginormous poster that someone made, and it just links everything in the Stephen King universe together. Like, oh, this has a connection to this, and this has a connection to this sort of thing. And it's pretty crazy. I sort of want to print out a ginormous copy of it and just be like, all right, here we go. Here's how everything connects. Let's see if my brain can get a grip on how exactly he managed to do all of this.
It's like one of those the things on the wall of an evidence dungeon where it has like string linking it between all of these different events and places.
Pretty much. They do use different colors.
Yes, I have to see this and possibly do the same, because that's nuts that one author has created such a overlapping and interspersed world with each other. All the leaves fold together, as it were.
Yeah, and it almost feels like that's something that really started with this book too. Obviously, you have really huge titles from him before this. You know, you have The Shining, you have Carrie, and it's just crazy how his brain put all of this together. I still can't get over it.
Yeah, I know. It's something that it obviously has taken him years, and like all good writers, or any writers, I don't think there's so much subconscious that goes into your writing that all of a sudden you like turn the corner when you're writing a book and you're like, oh, this relates to this old book somehow. Huh, I had no idea. Because I know that King is an author who writes, he has an idea, he sits down, he starts the book and he writes it. And he said that, you know, sometimes the end comes and I'm surprised that that's how it all came out. And I tend to do the same thing when I write. And you can tell. And whether or not that's a good or a bad thing is going to be up to the individual reader. Like whether or not you're willing to just kind of go along with this journey and see how it comes out. Because sometimes it feels like stories are just there. They exist. And all it takes is the right person to write them. You know, I kind of feel like there's two ways of thinking about a story. And I think for King, it's that. There are stories that exist and he is, you know, the writer of them. And he has no idea how things are going to turn out until they do.
Right. I do want to backtrack quite a bit here, because this entire story actually is sort of loosely based off of a short story that was collected in Night Shift, and that is Night Surf, which is a post-apocalyptic short story by him. And this story, it has to do with a plague as well, and it is called Captain Trips. So that's sort of the connection between the two. And I honestly didn't catch on to that. So I am very glad that the internet exists and can tell me these things.
You're right. I know. That's the nice thing about the internet. It will let us know.
Yeah. Like I said, we could have spent a ton of time diving into every little detail in both editions of this book, which now I kind of really want to see what those extra 300 to 400 pages look like, just because, you know, it's one of those things where you want to know what all he left out and sort of why it was left out. But that will have to wait for another day, because The Stand is already very long and I have a lot of other books to get through.
Right. I know. There's always so much more. There's always more coming, because he always is publishing. But yes, I think The Stand is definitely one it's worth thinking about and it's worth pondering. So I'm glad that we were able to sit down and talk about it.
The last thing I want to ask you here is, you know, I gave this a 5 out of 5 star rating on Goodreads. Do you tend to rate books, or do you sort of just go with how you feel? And it's like, okay, this is how I feel about the book. I don't need to put, you know, a star rating on it.
I rate everything. I write movie reviews. So I just have, my brain has a tendency, like when I get out of a movie or I finish a book, it's just like, well, I think that was a number out of number.
Yeah.
You know, this for me would be a 5 out of 5. I think it's such a captivating read, and it is such a vivid imagining of a certain scenario in the world. And I think that scenario would be entirely different now, but it is a snapshot of what the world was like in the 80s and early 90s.
Right.
So I think it's an incredibly well-written book, regardless of the controversy around the ending. But yeah, I think this is one of his better books, personally.
I think it's a huge lesson in how to handle writing a massive amount of characters into one story, too. Because even though only 0.6 of the population exists, he seems to talk about at least half of them in this.
Right, exactly. There's so much going on. And it feels like, and even with that, it still feels like you're just getting a peek, just this tiny peek into the world. And part of that, I would guess, is because in the complete and unedited edition, there is a lot more snapshots, like a lot of snapshots of this is what's going on in this side of the world and this and that and the other thing. So it feels like there's like these people are existing in a world with now a whole lot of unexplored space. But where there are groups of people, it's chaotic and a lot is happening all at once all around the world.
Yeah, I feel like we will definitely be diving into Randall Flagg a lot more once we hit the Dark Tower series. I know you and I will be discussing at least a couple of those books. So it's one of those things where, you know, this was a really great introduction to the character, to how brutal he can be. And it isn't even the whole story. You know, there's so much more to learn about Randall Flagg than what we get in this book. And it's just like, oh, here's a little nibble for you to, you know, get you hooked and want to come back for more.
Right. It's a taste, just a little taste. And then you're like, oh, this character keeps continuing. Oh God, I got to know what he does next. Even though he's an evil bastard.
Yeah. It's one of those things where the villain is just so fascinating. And like you said, this is probably one of King's best villains. And the fact that he just keeps bringing him back is sort of a testament to just how much of a presence he has, not only in our minds, but apparently in Stephen King's, if he keeps having stories to write with him in it.
Right, exactly.
Awesome. Well, is there anything that you think we missed that you want to touch on real quick before we wrap up here?
I would say that if you, for some reason, have not yet read The Stand and you're listening and you've made it this far into the podcast, please go give it a read. It is such a fascinating book. And if you're not into reading that much, the audiobook as read by Grover Gardner is really good. He is one of my favorite readers and he does this book a lot of justice. So it's easy to do, folks. Give it a listen.
Quickly here, I do want to talk a little more specifically about Nadine Cross because we mentioned her in passing, but I feel like we didn't talk about her enough to do her character some justice because, you know, she has an interesting journey. She goes from being a private school teacher to being seduced by the allure of Flagg. And those are two very, very different things. So, you know, you have her going on this journey as well. And, you know, she finds this young boy and she just ends up calling him Joe. And she clearly wants to help him because, you know, I feel like anytime you have a teacher for, you know, the good ones out there, that's sort of their nature. They just want to help kids and have them learn and all these things, but they're being followed too. So you have sort of this creepiness similar to what Fran was going through. You know, she had this worry all the time. And then you just have these creepy people following Nadine Cross and the boy.
Right. Yeah. Nadine is one of the more conflicted characters in the book. And I find her, and as she is slowly taken over by the dark, even as she resides within the light, it's so fascinating. And I love her character, even though at times I'm like, girl, just get over it. Either do it or don't. Get on the horse and ride away or abandon it forever because you can't have it both ways.
Right. She tries to sort of have a foot on each side of good and bad, and it is not going to work out that way for her.
Right. It's definitely not. And she kind of knows it from the beginning, almost. You can tell that she knows it, but that she almost can't do anything about it. She's trapped within this longing and this ownership by Flagg. And it's very sad as much as it is angering. But at the end, Nadine shows her her true alliance and her strength. And that's one of the more satisfying moments of the book for me, even though we lose her because of it, is that Nadine is totally unwilling to just give up. She struggles to the very end of her life.
Yeah, another character I really liked too, you mentioned earlier, was Nick Andros, and he's deaf and mute. So, you know, he can barely communicate with people. He finds a way to, you know, he can write things down and everything like that, but he ends up befriending the local sheriff and his wife after he is arrested. So you have this character who is impaired in a way that most people would find too difficult to deal with, probably, especially under these circumstances. It's like, okay, you know, if you can't keep up, you got to go. And I really like that they don't do that to him, and he's able to keep up with people. And it's just another interesting character to add to the mix.
He even becomes a leader at the end, you know, at the end of his story. Like, he becomes a leader in the community and is
right.
such a pure force for good. And not because of his disability, but just because of who he is. And that is so uplifting. That is one of the reasons that I kept reading. Because if the book gets too dark, unless you're really into grim dark fiction, which I can be sometimes, but wouldn't be for this story, he is one of the points that keeps the reader going for hope.
Right.
He provides a hopeful aspect to the story that is even better because he's deaf. Because he's not stopped by what other people would consider his limitations.
I totally agree. Well, I think that wraps up everything I have to say about some of these other characters here. I mean, for the most part, you have a lot of men that are focused on in this. And,
yep.
you know, I feel like the women characters do get enough attention, considering just, you know, the ratio of how many of them there are versus how many men there are. And like you said, Stephen King does have a knack for sort of writing certain characters the right way. And I really think he did a lot of that with this book. You know, it's not totally about the plot. You get so much more if you focus on the characters. And I really like that about this book.
Yeah, I do too. It's just so fascinating. Everyone is so different.
Yeah.
None of them are at all alike. And I just love that when everybody has their own little bit to contribute to the story and make it a more well-rounded and interesting story, and gives the characters a lot to play off of, you know, each other, and that some of them don't like each other and some of them love each other. And so some of them are a little of both. And it adds a lot of depth to this kind of story where we're dealing with such a spare level of support and supplies and resources, and everything is so dependent upon the character's cooperation that it makes it all the more interesting a read when it's really hard for those characters to cooperate because of their inherent nature.
Absolutely. On that note, I think we can definitely wrap this up here, Katie. Thank you so much for coming on to talk about this behemoth of a novel.
Thank you for having me. It's so fun to talk about. I love talking King, and this one is particularly fun to discuss.
Yeah, it definitely was a pleasure to talk about this. And for our listeners, you can follow the podcast on Twitter at Chat Cemetery, the same for Instagram, and you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google, wherever you listen to podcasts, you can find us. And as always, thank you all for listening.